I think it's the only option that's currently on the table. There are no options to assign a fixed percentage of this fishery to the scallop fleet. I hope that that will become a priority for the council to deal with very soon. This motion, if you support this motion, I hope that there will be a provision in it similar to the way the Georges Bank yellowtail allocation works this year, when there's a projection, if the scallop fleet isn't actually going to catch the entire allocation, that it reverts back to the groundfish fleet. So I hope somebody would make sure that that is added to this option, which will improve it slightly from our perspective. And I would also at this time ask to clarify that with your previous vote, since you changed the way the Georges Bank yellowtail is currently allocated, is that mechanism still in there for a return to the groundfish fleet if it isn't caught by the scallop fleet? Thank you.
Drew Minkiewicz.
Jeremy Cavis, Fisheries Survival Fund, support the motion on the board. As far as, it is the only option in front of you right now. As far as percentages, on Southern New England, the only thing I would caution about it going forward in the future is, if I correct Tom, Southern New England is now managed under the new recruitment assessment, so it's no longer overfished. That decision was made?
Yes.
Okay, so now we're under the new, this is as good as it gets model. So we're under a new future and different assumption for where we were in the past. Basically, the assumption is we're going to be at a lower level, but a stable level going forward. And so historical catch numbers against the old numbers aren't very good indication of what's actually going on in the fisheries going forward. And we should take a few years to see how things move under this new model, the new, this is what it's going to be now model. As far as the fungibility of yellowtail between the two fisheries, completely agree that that should just be standard standard in these allocations, that if it's not all used up and someone's gone over their their sub ACL, but the overall ACL hasn't been used, that the way is to slide it between the scallop and the groundfish fishery to maximize the use of this limited resource for the nation should absolutely be used in all instances.
Anyone else? Chris.
Chris Brown, Rhode Island Commercial Fishermen Association. We're in a market-based system, or at least that's what I was told. When we get into it, we have competing factions here for the same resource and no way to rectify it business to business for money. This is a different situation than Georgia's. Southern New England seems to be locked in at a level that pretty stable. We have a little bit of fish to work with. It's not a crisis situation, but I think we should demand as an industry that there is a mechanism created either in the short term as an emergency action or in the long term down the road a little bit so that we can get about the business of trading quota for dollars to make all of this not necessary. This is just a business-to-business transaction. 90% of what you need, like the speakers before me have mentioned, is on the table. And probably that's what we're going to end up with for this year. But going forward, we need to lock them into a specific percentage of yellowtail, winter flounder, and sand dabs. It's just time for it. We need to be able to trade quota and solve problems. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? George.
Yeah, a question I guess maybe for Tom. Is there any provision or will there be a provision discussed in a few minutes to allow in-season transfer of a fish from the scallop fishery to the groundfish fishery, similar to what we have for yellowtail? Or has that not been considered?
That hasn't been considered for southern New England yellowtail.
Council, comments, discussion? Tom Dempsey.
I think that is an important issue, and I think perhaps if people are comfortable with it, the way to deal with that is to amend this motion to include that in-season trading provision so that we don't simply repeat the same mistakes of this approach that we ran into the last time. So I think it is important to include that flexibility. We heard that both from the scallop industry and the groundfish industry. So with that said, I move to amend and simply add at the end to include in, as a part of this alternative a mechanism similar to the one used currently. Oops, I'm going too fast. Sorry. In Georgia's Bank yellowtail flounder for in-season transfers between the sub-ACLs of the groundfish and scallop fisheries.
The maker of the motion is willing to accept that as a friendly.
Oh, yeah. Head on.
Further discussion? Seeing none, I will call the question. All those in favor of the motion so indicate. Sixteen in favor. Did Tom, did you have a question?
Well, the way the motion's worded, it implies that the transfer can go both ways. It can't go both ways because the sectors have until the end of the year to use all of their quota. And the assumption here in the way it works on Georgia's Bank yellowtail flounder is that the scallop fishery is essentially done by January, and so you can make an estimate of what how much they're going to catch until the end of the year. The sectors have up until April 30th to catch all their yellowtail flounder. So, you know, it's really a one-way trade. It goes... If the scallopers don't use it, it gets released to the groundfish fishery. It doesn't go the other direction.
Tom.
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify. That is the intent of this motion. I'm not sure what, if any, of the words need to change, but the way I read this, it means that. And with the clarification of the intent, I think we can move forward.
Okay. Since Tom had made that clarification, I'm going to go back to the original vote. Okay. All those in favor? So indicate. 16 in favor. Opposed. Abstention. 16-01. The motion carries. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. Having trouble following along, you indicated there were, I don't know how many motions. We have two committee meeting summaries. These are not committee motions that we're dealing with. And I'm just process-wise here, is there one document that has something I could follow along so I know where we're at and what's coming up next?
No. when we teed off the meeting there, we talked about first the brief update on Framework 48, the CAT report. These issues, and I have one more allocation motion, and then we move into the Framework 48, and those would be in the two committee reports.
Okay, well, that was helpful. And it is our intention to take all of the committee motions from the two committee meetings and deal with them today. That is what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
There's coffee down there. And somebody said they have ice cream sandwiches there, too. Terry?
Okay, this is the last allocation issue. It's approval of the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Windowpane Flounder allocation of the scallop fishery. This is not a committee motion, so I move that the council adopts as a preferred alternative Framework 48, Section 4.1.2.2, establishing a scallop fishery sub-ACL for southern New England mid-Atlantic windowpane flounder.
Motion needs a second. Tom Dempsey. I'm going to go to the audience. Discussion. Were you trying to raise your hand, Dee? Drew Minkiewicz.
Drew McCabe's Fisher Survival Fund. I'm a little concerned that you haven't really gotten a recent presentation on this issue to really put this issue into context. Because, one, mid-Atlantic windowpane is one of the unallocated species. There have been some spikes in catch over the last couple of years, but generally the catch is quite low, especially in the scallop fishery. The scallop fishery has a lot of concern, frankly, about their estimated catch because there was a highly publicized event where a lot of the reserve coverage was written down as sand SD, and it was sand dollars and not sand dabs. We were told that is corrected, but we're not confident it was fully corrected, and there's a lot of uncertainty and concern about what's actually being attributed to the scallop fishery as far as catch in this fishery because, frankly, scallopers just don't see dabs coming up over the deck very often. It's just not something they really encounter at all. So what's being caught doesn't really jive with what is being attributed to them. We would recommend not adopting this motion because going the unallocated road is a much better way going forward on this fishery where there is no directed fishery for it, period. Dabs aren't really something people target at all or really ever have. So this is just a solution looking for a problem, and it's going to create a lot of problems for you guys going forward. So if you want more entertaining afternoons like we already have had, vote for this. Or if you want to actually go forward in a productive fashion and not have these destructive fights, then I would strongly encourage you to vote no.
Thank you, Raymond.
Thank you, Chair. We do, Associated Fisheries of Maine, we do support this motion. And I have a question. Would this, if this motion passes, would the scallop committee then develop the accountability measures for any overage on the sub-ACL?
Yes. Assuming this motion were to be passed and then approved by the service, the plan would be that the scallop fishery would have to develop AMs for southern New England mid-Atlantic windowpane flounder in their next action. I think they're planning an action next fall, but I'm not certain of that.
So it could be that the accountability measure might not go into place for a year or more.
But it's hard to predict. I mean, from the ground fish perspective, the expectation would be they would develop an accountability measure, adopt it in their next action, and it would apply retroactively to their catches in 2013. But I don't, you know, that's a long way from being done yet.
Anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am concerned about the details and review of this measure in a little bit more depth, and I'd like to make a motion to table until December 20th council meeting, at which time final action on Framework 48 will take place.
Motion to table. That have to be seconded. Yeah, but it has to be seconded. Is there a second to that? Seconded by Peter Kendall. It's not debatable. If somebody has a process question, we can answer that. Otherwise, we'll go right to the vote. David Gaetham.
If this motion passes and we defer action to the final vote, where are we in terms of having had two meetings for public discussion of the framework?
Yeah, somebody said we're having a discussion now, and then we'll have the discussion again.
I would think you need to vote up an alternative today, and that would be what the public discusses, and then have the final meeting for the second meeting. Myself, I mean, I don't. We haven't even said whether or not we're going to use this alternative.
Well, I have to rely on Gene, and he's not shaking his head this way. So I think we're okay. Paul, did you want to make a comment?
I would assume that this would become an alternative, be analyzed, but it would not be the preferred alternative going forward. Be one of alternatives, that's all.
Tom?
Yeah, we're trying to get this issue put behind us, much like the other yellowtail ones. If this motion's tabled, then we would vote on this at the final meeting in December. This is an alternative we've been talking about probably since last May sometime. This isn't the first time it's come forward.
Okay. We're getting into a debate on this. Call the question. All those in favor of the motion to table? One, two. Two in favor. Opposed? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 14. Abstention? Okay. 2-14-0. The motion fails. So we're back on. Motion. Further discussion. Call the question. All those in favor of the motion? Twelve in favor. Opposed? Three opposed. Abstention? One. 12-3-1, the motion carries. Terry.
Okay, everyone, we're moving into the Framework 48 specific issues, and I refer to the document starting on page 32, 4.1.2.3. Tom and I are going to tag team this, and hopefully he can provide a little bit of context, and I have a number of committee motions.
Give me a second to catch up to myself here. So I'm having a little trouble, technical difficulties here, and I will fix them momentarily. I'm going to go through some issues that the Groundfish Committee raised, and I'm going to go kind of through them in order, and then Terry has some committee motions. And when I go through them in order, basically I'm going to try and go through them in the order of the Framework 48 document, which is item number 7 in your binder. And as we page through it, I will try and highlight exactly what it is we're talking about and try and explain what the rationale is for these things. The first one I'm going to talk about is the other subcomponents, sub-ACL for Southern New England Mid-Atlantic winter flounder, window pane flounder, which is on page 32. And perhaps I should have given this before the previous motion, but I didn't. One of the issues we have with Southern New England Mid-Atlantic window pane flounder is illustrated on this picture, which is difficult to see in the light here. This is the 2010 fishing year window pane flounder catches, and it's hard to see, but this is groundfish catch, the small blue pie shape in the upper right-hand corner. The scallop is the 33% that you see down here. And then over to the left, this other large chunk is basically other trawl fisheries. That's 47%. If you break the other trawl fisheries component down by mesh size, again, this is difficult to see, but basically this little tiny chunk up in the – these little tiny chunks here are less than 5-inch trawl mesh, and all the others are 5 inches or greater trawl mesh. And this is non-groundfish trips. If you go to 2011, you see that we have a similar problem in that about half of the catch is by other trawl fisheries that we don't manage. A little less than a quarter is groundfish, and about another is quarter in scallops. So this is the issue that we were wrestling with Southern New England Mid-Atlantic window pane flounder, and how do we deal with this? We've only got an accountability measure on the groundfish fishery. We don't have it on these other components, and they're catching 75% of the catch. And so we've adopted a sub-ACL for the scallop fishery, and we were considering adopting a sub-ACL for these other fisheries. The first approach the groundfish committee looked at was trying to identify what fisheries those were. And while generally they're the fluke and the scup fisheries and some other fisheries managed by the Mid-Atlantic Council, we're a little concerned with our ability to actually assign catch to different FMPs because people can fish on multiple FMPs on the same trip and the same tow, for that matter. And so we went back and we looked at it and we said, well, one way to approach this is we might be able to take the accountability measure and have it apply to a gear type rather than have it apply to a fishery. And so we're doing two things in this action, or proposing two things in this action to account for that. The first that I'm talking about here is that we're talking about creating a sub-ACL for these other trawl fisheries. And then later, Terry will bring forward a motion that establishes an accountability measure for these other trawl fisheries. Now, this is, as you might expect, there's been a little bit of confusion, I think, with the Mid-Atlantic Council and with Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission about what it is we have in mind. There was some confusion that we were asking the Mid-Atlantic Council to change their regulated mesh size. We're not. All we're actually doing is we're talking about taking the accountability measure for Southern New England Mid-Atlantic windowpane flounder, which as currently written only applies to groundfish trips, and making it apply, should the AM be triggered, making it apply to all trips that use large mesh otter trawls, with large mesh otter trawls defined as gear over 5 inches. That's the measure that you'll talk about later when Terry puts up the accountability measure issue. It's one of the groundfish committee motions, I believe. So this is where we're at on this, but this is the explanation of the deal we're dealing with. And why is this important? Well, quite honestly, we've been going over the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic windowpane flounder ACL. And while the ACL will increase significantly this year because of the updated assessment, it's still a you need to have accountability measures that are actually going to work should they get triggered at reducing the catches. This is just sort of an update. There's been a lot of confusion about this issue, so I thought it was worth bringing up. I don't believe Terry actually has a motion for this. This is something we'll decide in December, but this is just an update to bring you up to speed on where we're at on this.
Thanks, Tom. Do you want to take any questions, Rip, or before I move on with the motion?
Let's put the motion up.
Well, I don't have a motion on this. I do have a motion on 4.1.4.2 on small mesh fisheries sub-ACL for Georgia's Bank yellowtail flounder. It's a committee motion.
That's my next talk. I'll do it first, and then Karen can put the motion up. So just real quickly, for the AMs for Southern New England window pane, the AM requires the use of selective trawl gear in these blocks, if the overage is up to 20%, and then in all of these blocks, if the overage is over 20%. Moving on, this is an issue that you've heard about a couple times today. One of the things we do when we go through the ACL specifications is the groundfish PDT sits down and look, you know, we divvy up the ABC and the ACL to these different components. The regional office then takes the fishing year 2011 catches, bins them into these components, and the PDT goes back and looks at it and says, how did we do? And we make recommended changes for how to distribute the components. And so this table reflects how the distribution of these components has changed over time. And the way this table works is that the numbers reflect the allocation that's being made. If it's a red number, it's an indication that the allocation to that component or the allowance for that component in case of the states is going up, which means the groundfish fishery gets less in federal waters. If it's a green number, it means the allocation or the amount being allocated goes down, in which case the groundfish fishery gets more. So red is bad, green is good. And you can see how things have changed over time, which is why we put this up. And the one that so far is attracting a lot of discussion today, but there's actually a couple of them in here, is that in Framework 48, we're proposing that for Georges Bank yellowtail flounder, the other subcomponent amount would need to be 18%. Now, this drew a lot of attention at the groundfish committee meeting because most of this 18% is due to small mesh fisheries catching Georges yellowtail on Georges Bank. And this is primarily the whiting and perhaps the squid fishery. And these fisheries occur not only in the whiting cultivator shoal fishery up around closed area 2, but also on the southern flank of Georges Bank, So this is what the groundfish PDT was recommending, and then I think this is at the point where Terry's motion comes into effect.
On that cue. Committee motion to include an option in Framework 48 that would allocate a percentage-based sub-ACL for Georges Bank yellowtail flounder based on recent catch history in the small mesh fishery. Pass the committee 801.
Committee motion, no second required. I'm going to go to the audience. Any comments? Tom.
So if you turn the pages to page 35, in anticipation of this motion, we drafted some draft text, I guess. At this stage, this is unlike some of the discussions on yellowtail and windowpane. This is not a final decision. This is putting a measure in the document for analysis. And since we really won't have time to come back and forth with the council and the committee, we drafted some language. And the language in here is we went back and looked at the recent history of small mesh catches. It ranged relatively small amounts in most years. Now, you can see the numbers stayed relatively the same except for 1 year. The percentages range from 1 to 4%. And so, you know, presumably at your meeting in December, you would pick something that's based on this table.
Chris Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, there is no reason to have any flounder bycatch problems in small mesh fisheries in 2012. There's no reason for it. We have developed a number of type of gears that are not the rule trawl that are very effective in eliminating winter flounder, yellowtail, and windowpane flounder. These are the 12-inch drop chain net that we worked on with the University of Rhode Island through the Research Trust Foundation on East Farm, and the large mesh panel in the small mesh nets that was worked on by some gentlemen from Montauk with Cornell University. At least My project is peer-reviewed, and I believe the Cornell project is, I believe that may be peer-reviewed as well. I'm not certain on that. I would absolutely implore you to make those gears mandatory year in, from one end of the year to the other, in all areas in southern New England throughout the range of groundfish. There is no reason for this industry to suffer as a result of waste in its other directed fisheries, winter flounder, yellowtail, and we don't need to create problems for the scallop fishery by killing more fish than we should. We can avoid it. It's time to modernize our thought process and fish much cleaner as an industry. It will not happen without you making it happen. I stood up before this council 2 years ago in New Hampshire and got poleaxed by industry for trying to make a recommendation to have the 12-inch drop chain net accepted throughout the range. They said it wasn't proven, it didn't work. Well, since then, it has been proven, and it does work, and there are a lot of boats that are using them. The trouble is, there are a lot of boats that aren't. So I would encourage you to investigate that. We could arrange to have those reports forwarded to the PDT and set about correcting something that is long due to be fixed. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Maggie Raymond.
Thank you. Speaking in support of the motion, and again, the question, who would develop accountability measures for this, for these fisheries? Would it be the groundfish plan that would do that? Or are we expecting the squid fishery plan to do that? I know we do it for whiting. That's a species that we manage, but I'm concerned about squid. Thanks.
Tom, do you have an answer for that, or is it going to...
No, not really. I mean, presumably we'd do it for the whiting fishery, and we would probably ask the squid fishery to do it for their own fishery. That's typically what we had in mind for some of these other ones.
Jeff Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. I'm Jeff Cable with Lunds Fisheries. I guess I don't necessarily have a problem with this, but we haven't – I'm just catching up to the fact that this is ongoing after tracking a lot of other things. But where's the data that on geographical basis and on a fisheries-wide basis so that we can analyze, you know, where this is happening and when? And I don't disagree with the approach Chris is taking. I know we've been involved in the Cornell study. I'm not sure where that is, honestly, on this drop chain approach. So we're just looking for the data so we can better understand where we are between now and December. I don't see anything in the document. Tom, I don't know what you guys have, how it's broken down, but...
Well, we provided the data on two instances to the Groundfish Committee. I think the first time was probably the August meeting where we tried to break it down by FMP. And then we broke... I might be mixing things. No, this is right.
Right.
Yeah, and then I think we also discussed it at the Groundfish Committee in October or November.
Well, I don't doubt that, but where do we see the numbers and the charts and stuff?
They should be in the PDT reports. I don't know if you actually plotted the locations because that info is confidential in many instances.
Right.
But,
well, we'll do some digging between now and December then because we don't know what's going on. We don't know what the problem is we've got to solve necessarily, but we're interested in solving it so we can stay operating. So thank you. I'll check that out.
Anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. Terry Alexander.
I don't know if it's appropriate or not, but I'd like to ask Chris the question. Is that appropriate? So you must need some as a bycatch, even if the drop chain, what is that? What's an appropriate number for that?
Yeah, you need some. I mean, nothing's perfect. I don't have a problem with fixing sub-ACLs into these fisheries. I just look at it as my job not to violate it. So go follow through with the process of fixing small sub-ACLs to these other fisheries, I guess, and then empower the industry with the tools to not violate them. That would be my suggestion.
David Pierce.
Yeah, I need a clarification. This motion comes out of committee discussion where I believe we talked about recent catch history in the smallmouth fishery and that it was around 18%, maybe 20%. So maybe I've lost track of where I am on this issue, but I thought that that was the concern, that we needed to consider something like 18% or 20% recent catch history, which is much too large. And then I look at the table just given to us by Tom, his reference to Table 7, and I see small mesh discards as percent of U.S. catch, and it's like 1%, 3%, 2%. But then in the rationale paragraph under the table, it says, while small mesh fishery catches of Georges Bank yellowtail flounder have generally been less than 100 tons in recent years, then it goes on from there. So what numbers are we talking about relative to what we actually would be setting aside as a sub-ACL of Georges Bank yellowtail for the small mesh fisheries? 100 tons? Something else? I don't know what this means relative to what actually could be allocated from the small amount of Georges Bank yellowtail available for allocation to all the users, scallop fishery, groundfish fishery, smallmouth fishery. So I need that all clarified.
Tom.
Sure. So to back up a minute, when we have an amount that is in other subcomponents, we start out with the ABC, and then we divvy it up into pieces. And one of the pieces that we sometimes divvy it up into is another subcomponents piece. And other subcomponents is usually not subject to an accountability measure, which is why we don't call it a sub-ACL. And typically, the other subcomponent pieces are small. Amendment 16 says, you know, if the other subcomponents piece gets above 5%, then the council needs to take a step back and think about whether they want to address that somehow. And so often when it gets above 5%, council members start arguing that we should make a sub-ACL and should subject that part of the fishery to an accountability measure. So we have somewhat of an interesting issue here with this instance with the whiting and squid fisheries in that their catches have ranged in the, 30 to 100 metric ton period, and that's been, whatever it shows in this table, a relatively small percentage of the catch. The problem is that in fishing year last year, I think their catch went up to around 40 tons or 38 metric tons. And when you start taking 38 or 33 metric tons out of 215, now you're talking about 15 or 18%. So the PDT walked in the room and we said, well, their catches have been in this ballpark. We think that you should be allowing for the other subcomponents about 18%. And the committee thought that was overly generous, and they said, well, let's go back and let's make it a sub-ACL and let's base it on history. Well, if you base it on history and you look at what percentage of their catch has been, then that's how you get these numbers that are in Table 7 on page 35. So, the council would have to come back in December and say, okay, using these numbers, we're going to base the percentage on whatever, the mean over the last 7 or 8 years, the 90th percentile, the median, something like that. Okay. And it would be much smaller than the 18%.
Okay, thank you for that clarification, because I left the meeting thinking that on the table we still had 18% or so. I didn't realize it would plummet down to a far better percentage for smallmouth fisheries. Smallmouth, they shouldn't be catching hardly any flatfish, for example. They should be fishing very sensibly, since they are fishing with small mesh, capable of catching juvenile groundfish, juvenile flounders, you name it. So, all right, if that's where we're headed, then if we are looking at maybe 1% or 2% of the total, that's in the ballpark that I wish to play.
Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask the Research Steering committee chair, if in fact you are aware of Chris's net design and the research, are you aware of that, and is it coming to the research steering committee?
We're aware of the research. I have not. I don't know if they submitted a final report yet. I'd have to check with Phil on that. I'm not aware of it. But as long as I'm speaking, I think you know, as part of this, people should look at page 62 in this document, which is kind of the second half of this equation, which is that if you adopt these numbers, then you adopt a requirement to use a raised foot rope trawl or a net like Chris has described. And that will keep you handily within these numbers. So it really is a two-part equation. It's adoption of the numbers and adoption of the bycatch reduction strategies, which are a number of nets. Some of them are listed here. We probably have to increase that list at this meeting.
Mark Gibson, did you have your hand up? No. Dave Preble.
Okay. In the 8 years that we have here, the average small mesh discards as a percent of U.S. catch was 2.5%, which on the basis of 215 tons would equal 5.38 metric tons. So I don't know how we... where we want to proceed, but that's the kind of numbers we're talking about.
Any other? Comments on Dave?
Yeah, I mean, I would recommend you adopt this motion, and then at the final meeting, you actually pick... as Tom said, you've got mean, median, 90th percentile here. They're all a little different. People could weigh in on which one they think is appropriate. And then at some point later on in the discussions today, we'll get on to the list of gear that would be used under this provision.
Further discussion? Chairman Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Coming into the final meeting, I wonder if we could have a little more sense of what the quality of some of these catch estimates are in terms of discard estimates. We're coming out of a period of time with some of the small mesh fisheries where we didn't have very extensive observer coverage, certainly in the mid-Atlantic region. And going forward, we'll have much better coverage, and with that, better understandings of interactions and catch. So I just wonder if we can have some better sense, perhaps between now and then, or discussion about the quality of some of those catch estimates.
Thank you. I call the question. All those in favor of the motion, so indicate. 17-0-0. Motion carries. Terry.
The next issue is on page 51 of the document, section 4.2.1.2, revised accountability measures for the recreational fishery. Turn it over to Tom.
So the issue here is that with the expected low ACL for Gulf of Maine cod and the known low ACL for Gulf of Maine haddock next year, it's likely that the recreational fishing measures will need to be revised. And the problem is that we don't know what the cod number is yet, so we can't actually design recreational measures yet. So we ran into a little bit of a problem on how we were going to do this, and the solution that we came up with is option 2 on this page. Plus, this also addresses some long-range issues with managing the recreational fishery. The idea here is right now the recreational AMs can only be used to modify measures if the recreational ACL is exceeded, so it's after the fact. And the idea here is we modify the AM so it becomes a proactive AM, which means if we're looking forward and it appears that we might exceed the ACL, the regional administrator can modify the measures in advance. It also allows the regional administrator to modify the measures should it appear that the recreational fishery is going to fall well short of their catch, something that is not currently in the plan at all. Now, with all that, the recreational fishermen and the council typically want to have some input in this discussion, and they always have on the recreational EMs. So we've written in here some preliminary guidance and also some process procedural issues where the idea is that the regional administrator would have to consult with a council. The council would try and consult with its recreational advisory panel, make some recommendations to the RA about what measures should be implemented. And then we write in here that, you know, if the RA decides not to choose our measures, that the RA has to explain why, which is something that typically happens anyway in the proposed rule when they talk about their alternatives. Now, there's some guidance on page 52, much of which came out of the recreational advisory panel, on things that they would like to see the regional administrator consider. And after some discussion at the committee meeting, we tried to modify some of the language and the rationale to make it clear that, you know, this guidance isn't really intended to be binding on the RA. It's what it says it is. It's guidance for the RA to consider. And, you know, this is what the preferences of the RAP were on how to adjust measures. But, you know, obviously we're not tying the hands on the decision on what the regional administrator can do. So in some respects, this is a way to get us out of our box that we're in this year, but it also could have some long-term benefits, both for us and for the recreational fishery, in that it allows for measures to be modified early before an ACL has been exceeded, or relaxed early if we think that the ACL is not going to be caught. The intent here most of the time is that these measures would be done and announced, you know, sometime in the winter, so that recreational party charter boats know what's coming up next year when they book their trips. The reality is this year, with the way Framework 48 works, the reality is that the announcement on what the measures is going to be is probably not going to happen until, at the earliest, the announcement on whether or not Framework 48 is approved or not and what the implementing measures are going to be.
Committee motion. To include in the Framework 48 the alternative outlined in the draft recreational measures text as recommended by staff, pass committee 802.
Committee motion, no second required. I'm going to go to the audience for any comments. Back to the council, David Pierce.
So this would be a proactive accountability measure. And just a clarification, this could be triggered in season within the fishing year if, through monitoring, it's determined that the recreational fishery may exceed the sub-ACL. That's the question. Is it in season?
Well, the measure as written doesn't preclude in season. What it says is, to the extent possible, changes to rec measures that result from anticipated changes in sub-ACLs will be made before the start of the fishing year. And that's because of the problems. First, we have communicating changes. Second, giving the states time to modify measures. And third, allowing party charter fishermen to be able to tell their customers what regs they're going to have before they go fishing.
Okay, yeah, because in-season adjustments wouldn't make much sense, because how in the world can we, in a timely way, monitor what the recreational fishery has caught and then act, plus with states being asked to implement similar measures inside state waters, it poses all sorts of administrative problems, in-season adjustments. This may itself still provide some problems for us, but they may not be insurmountable. Okay, you've clarified that for me, Tom. Thank you.
John Bullard.
So we appreciate the confidence that council gives to the regional administrator. It means that should we do something like closing black sea bass, means we can't blame the council, like we're doing our best to do with your colleagues down in the mid-Atlantic. So very smart to avoid that. That lesson.
Doug Grout.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I certainly respect the input that the RAP has provided here, I am always puzzled at the preference for increasing the minimum size limit as the preferred method for a proactive AM, especially given that a lot of times that turns harvest into discards. And unless we have a significantly lower discard mortality rate than what we're using right now. And so I'd be very, I hope the, if we do give the regional administrator this authority, that they'll take that into consideration. And just a comment that I find it puzzling, although I know why they're doing it. I think it's a something that may end up having a different reaction than action than what they anticipate.
Yeah, just a comment, having been to all of those RAP meetings, that it's partially a product of the makeup of the recreational advisory panel. So, Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I supported this motion at the committee level because of two reasons. One is that there's a feedback loop in this at the bottom of page 51, which says that NIMS would consult with the council and would advise the council what measures are under consideration. And I think that's important to, because of Doug's point. As an example, with Haddock, I don't support and would never support increasing minimum size limits on haddock, because I think 100% of the haddock you throw back die. I don't care how you catch them. So that doesn't reduce mortality one bit. But that is what the RAP wanted as a first consideration. But because there's a feedback loop, we would be able to tell you that we don't support that, as an example, and give you reasons why, and then hope that you would, you know, move on to the next thing on the list, which in this case was change the bag limit so that we could keep mortality under control. But I think the feedback loop is important because it allows for this public process and this airing out of why, you know, the decision isn't made in the dark. It's aired out so that people will know. They may not like the decision. I guarantee you they probably won't. But at least they'll know why it was made and what went into it.
Frank Bond.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I voted against this in committee. I'm not sure if I did or not, but the I've always been in favor of seasons, unlike most people in the industry and most people in the recreational, because I think it's what does the most to actually do something about curtailing mortality. I'm glad to see that this measure goes forward and that we can finally relax measures, because since we've done Amendment 16, or maybe it was 13, I don't remember, there hasn't been any ability to relax the measures if needed. I'm very concerned with in-season adjustments. I know it's important not to go over. We're using the MRF's numbers for something it's not designed to do. Normally, at the end of the year, they're revised and they can go up or down. I don't know if it had any bearing or not on the sea bass issue or not. I just started looking at the numbers yesterday. There's something suspicious. It's in the shore mode on the sea bass fishery. In July and August, the state of New York, 2 years ago, landed 62,000 fish. Well, not landed. It's A B1s and B2s. They went from 62,000 fish 2 years ago to 5,000 last year to 664,000 fish this year in July and August. So from 5,000 to 664,000, and now we have an in-season adjustment. Whether that had a bearing or not on the closure, I don't know yet. I haven't looked into it. I know the service is looking into those, but I also, it's not much different for the state of Rhode Island. From 488 fish to 127,000 fish. So to use those type of numbers to do an in-season adjustment, I think we're using MRF's numbers wrong. I mean, from day one, you know, prior to being on the council, I don't know if anybody remembers it, I did something on, you know, MRF's numbers, fact or fiction. And my opinion was that overall, they're not bad numbers, but you have to take them on an average. You have to take out the highs and the lows and smooth out the data. But to use them for pinpoint information to be doing in-season adjustments, I think is the wrong way to go.
Yeah. Further discussion? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 65, 66, 67, 68, 69, 70, 71, 72, 73, 74, 75, 76, 77, 78, 79, 80, 81, 82, 83, 84, 85, 86, 87, 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, 93, 94, 95, 96, 97, 98, 99, 100, 101, 102, 103, 104, 105, 106, 107, 108, 109, 110, 111, 112, 113, 114, 115, 116, 117, 118, 119, 120, 121, 122, 123, 124, 125, 126, 127, 128, 15?
16.
16 in favor. Opposed? 1. Abstention? Frank, were you? I'm sorry. So you're opposed? Oh, you voted for it? 16-1-0, the motion carries. Terry.
Next issue is section 4.2.2.3.2, the removal of requirement for industry-funded at sea monitoring for in fishing year 2013.
So, for those who haven't been at the Groundfish Committee, this has been kind of a long, arduous attempt to try and figure out a better way to define what is the appropriate level of monitoring coverage for sectors. And I'm not going to go through everything we did with the PDT and the committee, but over the last year or so, the PDT has been spending a lot of time on this issue. The first thing that was somewhat surprising to us is that if you hunt around for information on an analytic basis of what the right amount of coverage is, you can find a lot of scientific papers written about coefficient of variation, but you don't find a lot of scientific papers written about how do you take into account the possibility that there's an observer bias when you're setting your coverage level. And we think that's kind of important because we did some work that indicates that there is evidence that there are monitoring effects on observed trips, that fishing behavior on observed trips differs from fishing behavior on unobserved trips. And I'd like to emphasize that this doesn't necessarily mean that there's anything nefarious going on. It's just a fact. And I'm going to draw from one of the conversations at our Groundfish Committee meetings, and I'm going to pick on one of our Groundfish Committee members who will know who he is right away when I bring it up. And, you know, the point is, you know, somebody said, well, look, you know, just, you know, if I'm a gill netter and I've got an observer on board, you know, I may just decide to go home rather than haul that last string because I may just not get along with the observer. And that's kind of exactly the point of the Groundfish Committee, the PDT. You know, that type of behavior doesn't necessarily mean you're discarding more or not. It just means your behavior is different on those trips, and so it's unclear whether discard estimates based on those trips are representative of the unobserved trips. Anyway, so the PDT spent a long time looking at this. We started with, you know, high hopes that we would figure out a way of figuring out how much this monitoring effect was and how it might influence discard estimates. And the long story short is we, as many other people probably have, ran into a brick wall, at least so far, as to how do you factor all this stuff in? You know, how do you know what you don't know? How do you know the unknowable on what's going on these trips and whether these monitoring effects are actually creating a bias in your discard estimates or not? They may not be. Just because somebody cuts the trip short doesn't necessarily mean his discard rate is higher than it was on an observed trip. So the PDT worked on that for a long time, and we really didn't come up any solutions. And so what we wound up with are the options that are in the document. One is a clarification of the CV standard. We had hopes that we would be able to come up with something related to monitoring effects, but we really didn't. And so you won't see that in the document here. And then this last option that Terry has a motion that he'll put up in a minute, if it's not already up on the board, is that, you know, we added an option here that says, okay, you know, to kind of flesh out the range of options here, that one of the options would be that in 2013, 1 year only, that the level of observer coverage would be the amount that could be funded by the government. I want to make it clear that this isn't specifying the 8% NEFOP standard. You know, at present, the federal funds are paying for more than that, so the expectation would be that it would be whatever the level of coverage was that could be paid for by federal funds.
Committee motion. To include in Framework 48 the PDT's Option X for observer coverage for fishing year 2013, at-sea monitoring coverage of sector trips at the level that NIMS can fund during fishing year of 2013.
Committee motion, no second required. I'm going to go to the audience for comments. Maggie Raymond.
Thank you, Chair. Speaking in support of the motion, and just want to say that, you know, that our membership supports the highest level of observer coverage that that can be had. It's in our benefit to have a high level of observer coverage because it brings our assumed discard rate way down. So, you know, we welcome observers on our boats. We just can't pay for them. So, you know, bring on as many as you can. We have no problem with that, but we simply can't afford to pay for them at this time. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Tom.
I left out of my discussion, this is a one-year thing. The expectation is that the committee and the council are going to wind up continuing to, and the PDT, are going to continue to wind up wrestling with this issue of what's the appropriate observer coverage level over the next year.
Back to the council. Dr. Pierce, and then John Bullard.
I won't oppose the motion. I understand the concern of the fishing industry. However, we all have to admit that we really don't know what's being caught. And with the low ACLs in place for 2013 and probably beyond, reflecting a plan development team concern that moving forward with, we're moving forward, and I personally have very little confidence in what's actually being caught, because of the observer coverage that will be at a very low level, because it's going to be all that NIMS can afford. Very low observer coverage. Someone said maybe it was Tom, maybe it was somebody from the audience. You know, one out of every five trips is sampled, if that. So it's, we fool ourselves if we think that we really do know what's actually being caught in the ground fish fishery, despite the best efforts of, this continues to be one of my major headaches, in that analyses that are continuously brought forward for us to use relative to frameworks and amendments always reference what's actually being caught, and I have very low confidence. So I won't oppose it, but we're in the dark here.
John Bullard.
It's certainly clear what the motive is behind this, and I share it, but, you know, we can't set quotas based on how many fish we want there to be. We can't set observer coverage based on how much money we have to pay for it. I mean, that's not the way we make decisions. We set observer coverage levels based on goals that we need to set to monitor things like discard rates, not on how much money we have. And I mean, let's understand why we're doing this. So we want to pay for as much as we can pay for, but that what we have the money to pay for isn't what you set the levels of observer coverage at. That doesn't make any sense. And so the council sets observer coverage at the levels you need so you can measure discard rates. That's the reason you do it, right? Not how much money the industry or NIMS has to pay for it. So we oppose this motion.
Gene Martin.
Well, I basically was going to say a similar thing to what John just said, just to put a legal perspective on it. You know, the whole the success of the sector program is built upon our ability to reasonably and accurately monitor catch levels so that we can enforce the catch limits, which are, you know, ensure that we're meeting conservation requirements. We've now been sued twice on this issue, once in connection with Amendment 16, which we managed to prevail on, at least as to this issue. on grounds that we, you know, told the court that we were providing, that there was observer-level coverage that exceeded that necessary just for pure SBRM purposes. We're currently in litigation, as I reported earlier, and a challenge to how we determined the level of at-sea monitoring last year and whether it was rationally based to ensure that we do monitor these coverage levels, or these the catch and bycatch levels accurately. You know, I don't want you to act merely because to avoid lawsuits, but it does. These lawsuits indicate that there's real concern about the effectiveness of the sector program if we don't have good monitoring of catch and bycatch.
Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see this somewhat differently. I think in my mind this is largely just communicating the obvious, which is we don't have any money to pay for monitors, so the coverage rate is basically going to be whatever NIMS can afford. I mean, we cannot afford, in my mind, I actually agree with what Maggie said, we can't afford a wholesale decline in overall observer coverage. We need that information. I think not having it, not having quality information is impacting our management decisions and impacting our assessments. But we simply don't have the money for it. The industry cannot pay for this. So in my mind, I support this approach because it's realistically just stating what we all know to be true, which is if you hand the bill to the industry, the groundfish fishery cannot go fishing. There's just no money there. So I think this is really what's going to happen regardless. It's going to be up to the National Marine Fisheries Service to fund observer coverage at the levels that they can. And that's going to be the situation that we're in for 2013 and possibly beyond.
Dave Gatham.
Yeah, I think Tom's pretty well stated my point. I mean, you can set any level of coverage you want. If there's no money to pay for it, the fleet ties to the pier, that's it. You'll be able to cover it because it'll be zero. That's the reality here. If people want observer coverage, whether it's National Marine Fisheries Service, the K Street educators for the NGOs, whoever it is, you better get to work with Congress right now and figure out where the money's going to come from. Most of us in the fishing industry don't believe there's going to be any disaster assistance. Let's be right up front about this. Therefore, there won't be any money that's proposed right now to pay for observers for the industry. Now, I personally believe after the election they're going to put a padlock on the Treasury and they're probably not going to unlock it for a long, long time because the country's broke. And so, you know, if folks think we need 30%, 40%, 50%, some fixed number, you all got deep pockets, dig into them. Because I don't. My pockets are empty. So I think this is just bowing to the obvious, as Tom said. You can either use whatever funding you have and fund some level of coverage, or you could set a fixed number. And come May 1st, everybody ties the boats to the pier for a general strike, and nobody goes fishing because they don't have the money. If I had to pay for an observer, as well as the fuel I'm paying for, as well as the leased fish, as well as everything else, I guarantee you I'm going backwards every single day. Some days I'm going backwards now with the leased fish and the fuel. But throw in money for observers, and I guarantee you I don't have one single profitable trip. Not one in a year. So I think you vote this up and admit this is reality. You know, sometimes reality was, well, I won't say that. Reality, you know what the phrase is. But that's it.
Gene Martin.
Yeah. Up this motion, sorry, will also preclude any kind of shared payment that we can devise between the industry and NIMS to help increase at-sea monitoring.
Doug Grout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Obviously, at-sea monitoring for a number of fisheries has been quite a challenge, and it's it's a challenge because of the cost. It is a very expensive proposition, and just as the National Marine Fisheries Service has said to the council that we cannot mandate in a management plan a level of coverage for them to pay for, where our industry is in a place right now where they're saying we can't afford to pay for this. And even before these drastic cuts that they're going to be facing, they were saying they can't afford to pay for this. And I think part of the problem is in Magnuson and the fact that there can't be some kind of a proportional cost recovery for it, because we right now it's a flat fee for the cost of observer boats, for observers on boats. And clearly the amount of money that a boat takes in depends on the size of their vessel. And so their ability to pay is even more drastic for the smaller boats than the bigger boats. But what I'm hearing even from the larger boats that they can't afford to pay for it, given the cuts that we're going to make. So it's a challenge. I think we all want to have more observer coverage to some point, up to some level, but how to pay for it, because the feds and states can't pay for it and the fishermen can't, is our biggest challenge.
Anyone else on the council? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion so indicate. Fourteen in favor. Opposed. Two opposed. Abstention. 1, 14, 2, 1. The motion carries. Terry.
Next issue is section 4.2.2.3.3. It's on the next page, 55. Lower at sea monitoring coverage rates for sector trips on monkfish days at sea in the southern New England broadstock area using extra large mesh gillnet gear.
So as the committee was wrestling with observer coverage issues, you know, one of the ideas that surfaced was let's spend money on trips that actually catch groundfish rather than trips that don't catch groundfish. And there were basically two categories of trips that were identified as possibilities. One was extra large mesh sink gillnet trips in southern New England, and the other was bottom longline trips, usually out of the Cape, that are targeting dogfish inshore. The service recently published a proposed rule for an exemption that would allow the targeting of dogfish on longline and I think St. Gilnet trips east of the Cape in certain seasons and certain times. So we're not trying to address that one. But another one that came up and that the committee considered is that there are a number of extra large mesh St. Gilnet trips in southern New England, which are on a monkfish day at sea and coincidentally often using a groundfish day at sea, so they're sector trips. So they're being subject to sector monitoring requirements, and they never catch more than 5% regulated groundfish. So in essence, what this measure proposes to do was to create another stratum for these trips to incorporate some metrics. That's not some metrics, to incorporate some tags in the databases so we could identify these trips afterwards and apply a reduced at sea monitoring coverage level to these trips in order to try and save some of the money on the observer coverage and spend it where it's more useful. There were some questions and comments brought up at the committee about, where should this be applicable? Should it be the whole southern New England broad reporting area? Should it be in Statistical Area 526? To be honest, we haven't had a chance to look at those questions yet. We'll try and look at those before the vote in December, but we haven't had a chance to narrow those down. And once again, this is just a vote to put this option into the document. It's not a final approval vote.
Committee motion to include the PDT's option 2, lower ASM coverage rates for vessels on a monkfish day at sea using extra large mesh sink gill nets in southern New England. Motion carried 5-1-2.
Committee motion, no second required. I'm going to go to the audience. Any comments?
Yeah, thank you. My name is Charlie Dodge. I'm a large mesh gillnet fisherman out of Chatham. I own three vessels at large mesh gillnet for monkfish. Currently, when we fish in the southern zone, we carry lots of observers. The sad part for you folks is that when we carry the observer, we leave the time we leave and the constraints for the time when we leave to fish the next day. You're getting charged for 3 days on one 36-hour trip. Three observer days makes it very expensive. We don't catch any ground fish down there. It's well documented. We've been doing this for years. I've been involved in the observer program before it was mandatory when they were back when it was just a couple of guys. I even take people on training trips. So I think this is a very good measure. I think this is a great idea because maybe you can get more information out of the ground fish trips and get more bang for your buck. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience?
Jim Nash, president of the fixed gear sector, Georgia's Bank fixed gear sector. I concur with the previous speaker. Our sector in the extra large mesh category has 0.5% discard rate for southern New England and for outside the Cape. As Charlie said before, we take a tremendous amount of observers. We also, many of our boats that fish for longline for dogs outside of Chatham also take observers. And quite frankly, I think it's very ridiculous to send a $900 observer to watch a guy make $540. So we really support this. I think it's a good way for the council to go, especially into the last motion in terms of getting the observer coverage where they actually need to be. Thank you.
Anyone else? Back to the council. George Darcy.
Yes, thank you. Both my staff and center staff, I believe, have raised some concerns about the implementation aspects of this measure. So I'll just repeat them here. One concern was that the center would have to reprogram the pre-trip notification system, which is the system that randomly determines what trips to place their observers on. And both our regional office monitoring team and the center have concerns that these ad hoc exemptions are resulting in increased monitoring complications that could impact future quota monitoring and assessment work. Thank you.
Council members, any comment? Tom Dempsey.
Thanks very much. I brought this motion, I believe, to the committee. I think it's the approach that we're going to need to take. We're going to need to find ways to target coverage to trips that are actually interacting with groundfish. That's our primary objective that we're actually passing in this framework. We need to measure groundfish catch, and I think this is one of at least one of the easier ones to get done, and I think we all know that we're going to be dealing with a very limited pool of monitoring resources. We've got to look for every way we can to direct that more efficiently. And I think this starts that process. So I support it.
Anyone else on the council? I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion? One, 15 in favor. Opposed? 1. Abstention? 15-1-0. The motion carries. Terry.
Next issue is on page 57, section 4.2.2.5.3. 100% dockside monitoring if full retention is adopted.
The only thing to comment on this particular motion is that notice the if. This came out of the groundfish advisory panel, the idea that if full retention is required, they felt that 100% dockside monitoring was critical in order to know what's coming across the dock to make sure that there aren't small fish coming, too many small fish coming across the dock. And it's intended to be tied in with a measure that's may not be talked about today, but will be considered later, which would require retention of all groundfish with no minimum size limits.
Okay, it's a committee motion.
Committee motion to add an alternative to Framework 48 under dockside monitoring requirement, Section 4.2.2.5, that would require 100% dockside monitoring with full retention, carried 5-4-1. Excuse me, 5-1-4.
Thank you. I'll go to the audience. Bring it back to the council. Doug Grout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm opposed to this motion. My rationale is this is tied to we go to full retention. I do not see how dockside monitoring would be used to help monitor or enforce full retention. I think for full retention, what you need to have is observer coverage to make sure that there is full retention going on at sea. I also have been opposed to dockside monitor because of the experience that some of the small communities that don't have a centralized landing location, it puts a tremendous burden on them and it's an increased cost to them. So I am very much opposed to this because it will not accomplish an objective to help monitor full retention and the cost that it would be borne by small communities.
Tom Dempsey.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to state that the advisory panel has now voted strongly, I think unanimously twice, to support this exact approach. That is, if you go to full retention, you need to implement 100% dockside monitoring. To Doug's point, I agree that implementing 100% dockside monitoring doesn't eliminate the need for at-sea coverage. It's a part of understanding how much fish is coming out of the water and over the dock. But I don't think it's the entire answer, and I don't think that this motion actually suggests what the ASM levels would be at all. I think this is silent to the at-sea component of the monitoring program. I do support this. I don't think that just because in 2010 we rolled out a pretty poorly implemented and ineffective and valueless dockside observer program, that dockside monitoring is therefore always unnecessary or always can't provide value. I think this is something that we should continue to look at. Our advisors have spoken strongly several times suggesting that. So I support this motion.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I oppose the motion for a number of the reasons that Doug listed, but I also want to call people's attention to New Zealand, where they have full retention. And been to New Zealand, I studied their fishery. It's pretty interesting. They have an entirely different legal system than we do. They have what are called instant fines. They can be up to $100,000 New Zealand. So there's an instant fine if you don't fully retain your fish. No court case, no probable cause, no nothing. Just guy walks down, hands you a $100,000 bill. And yet they still cannot enforce full retention. They, it is their number one enforcement problem. They chase people around the ocean all the time trying to find people tossing fish over the side. And believe me, they get very creative at ways to get them over the side. They're principal means of enforcement of the full retention principle is the recreational fishery, which chases the commercial fishery around trying to find somebody tossing a sculpin over the side. So I think you have to think about the practicality of a motion like this. It's not enforceable. Even with 100% observer coverage, it's not enforceable. It's the dockside monitors are almost irrelevant. All they're doing is counting up whatever you decide to bring to the pier. So they're only getting a subsample anyway. So I understand the rationale for full retention. You know, it's a magnetic thing that draws people on an emotional level, on a romantic level. I appeal to your practical side. romanticism went out of my life a long time ago. This isn't going to work. So if you want to chase good after bad, good luck. Where's Ellen, by the way?
John Bullard.
So I'd just like some clarification. Is this a vote that if the council were to ever require full retention, then there would be 100% dioxide monitoring? This is not a vote that requires full retention. Is that correct? Am I interpreting that?
It's just a vote to put something in a document. We haven't even voted on the. It's a vote to put something in the document.
Yeah, but the way you could require dioxide monitoring with full retention, that could be interpreted that you're requiring both dioxide monitoring and full retention. Or you could interpret that as you're requiring dioxide monitoring if you have full retention. I'm just trying to figure out which interpretation that is.
The way the option reads is this option would only be adopted if full retention, C4233 of regulated groundfish, would also be adopted for sector vessels.
And that would be a separate decision, which would be a big decision. That's not what's contemplated in this. Okay, thank you.
Maggie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as the maker of this motion at the Groundfish Advisory Panel, I'd like to clarify that this was never meant to be any kind of enforcement measure. With full retention, some people have concern that people would target small fish. Other people argue that won't happen. Right now, we really don't know how many undersized fish are discarded. In a full retention program, we would have a better understanding of how many undersized fish are caught, killed, and landed if we have those monitored at the dockside. So the intent of this was to try to get a handle on the number of small fish that would be landed in a full retention program, because if that number is big, then that needs to be accounted for in the assessment. Right now, we do account for discards of undersized fish in the assessment, but we don't really know what that number is. So this is just really to try to get a better handle on the number of small fish that would be caught, killed, landed in a full retention system. So nothing to do with enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else on the council? Doug Grout.
Well, just to that point, and I hope you, everybody will see the rationale behind this, but right now we have a dealer reporting system, and there are people that come in and get length measurements on these fish. And why wouldn't, if you had a full retention system, why wouldn't there be a system like that? It's not, you don't have to have everything measured, but right now we're getting samples of them. So you'd have that piece of information for stock assessments with the current system we have without dockside monitoring.
Anyone else? Peter Kendall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I go back and forth on this motion because I'm okay with having a conversation about full retention, which certainly is not in this motion. That's down the road. But I do not see the need. Dockside monitoring, to me, is it seemed like it was a waste of money before, and it could be a waste of money again. I mean, to Dave and Dave's point, if you're not observed on that trip, I mean, you might not bring in the fish to begin with. You still might be throwing them over. So what's a dockside monitor going to do? I mean, you can't quantify that anyways. So That's just a point. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion? Three. Opposed? Twelve opposed, abstention, one. 3-12-1, the motion fails. Terry.
Next issue is section 4.2.3.2, add an alternative with minimum size suggested by the groundfish advisors.
So where this came from is originally the document had no changes to the minimum size as one option and full retention, meaning no minimum sizes at all, as the other option. When it went to the groundfish advisory panel, the groundfish advisors suggested a kind of a midpoint option, if you will, where they came up with some suggested minimum sizes, which generally are based on the length at 50% maturity. And those are shown on page 58. In a table that doesn't have a number on it. And I think their idea here is that some people are uncomfortable with the idea of having no minimum sizes at all, which might create, allow for the creation of fisheries targeting very small fish. And they felt that a midpoint or something in between the current minimum sizes and no minimum sizes would be a good option. The argument for getting away from the current minimum sizes are that in some instances there are substantial discards at fish links that are just below our current minimum sizes.
Committee motion to amend framework 48, section 4.3.3.2 to include the minimum fish sizes recommended by the groundfish advisors. Passed 9-0-1.
We're going to go to the audience for any comments. Back to the council. Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I think people are getting tired. I won't belabor the point, but I think these numbers are about reality. They recognize what's currently being caught, and people are worried about discards. This basically solves your discard problem. These are still marketable fish, and it'll get the discard level down to virtually nothing because these are the fish that are being discarded right now. It's caught between 19 and 21 inches, haddock between 16 and 18, pollock stay the same, witch flounder come down an inch, yellowtail, there's a huge number of yellowtail between 12 and 13 inches. It's virtually all the discards. Dabs, same thing, between 12 and 14. Dabs don't charge a twine well for some reason. That's the dabs that are being discarded now. Winter flounder stays the same. You don't catch winter flounder under 12 inches anyway with 6.5-inch mesh. And redfish, again, it's about a reality. If you're going to have a redfish fishery and you're going to be bringing up volumes of redfish, I don't know how many of you have ever tried to measure a redfish. I just had 40,000 of redfish. I'm going to sit there and try and measure these spiny little buggers. Most of your crew is going to die of gurry poisoning. So, again, it's about a reality. At 7 inches, there probably aren't going to be any under that. They're unmarketable under 7 inches anyway. It allows them to shove them through a bunker plate and be legal.
Anyone else? David Pierce.
Yeah, is there any idea as to how the states will respond to this particular action if it is adopted and implemented? Since states have minimum sizes for all these fish, we would have to put a public hearing, agree to go to public hearing, and then reduce the minimum sizes. So any reaction from the states?
I thought we were going to get a reaction from the state.
Well, you'll get one from me right now, and that is, at this point in time, not very receptive to it. I understand the logic for it, but there's a reason why we have the minimum sizes in place right now, related to age of maturity, et cetera, providing incentives for fishermen to avoid those sizes of fish. And there were a number of other reasons as well, getting to age at first maturity, or more importantly, to the age or size when they can spawn at least twice, which seems to be a far more beneficial thing than it would have been first-time spawners. So not very receptive to it, not going to oppose it, but boy, there better be some real convincing arguments for us to go through all the administrative necessities of making these changes and to, in many instances, I suspect, adopt minimum sizes for the commercial fishery that could be far less, that is much smaller than the recreational fishery. So that's a problem. So that's my perspective at this time, but again, I'll wait for more text to accompany the rationale as to why this is important and why the downsides should be set aside by the states.
Jim Weinberg.
Yeah, I understand that the intention here is to reduce regulatory discards, but for a lot of these stocks, their biomass is low, and the way to rebuild them is through the stock recruitment relationship. You take away the spawning biomass, you reduce your chances of increasing the stock. And it just seems that if you're setting a policy based on being able to take fish when half of them are not yet reproductive and half are, at that 50% of maturity size, that it's kind of not going to promote the rebuilding of these stocks. So just an issue, a concern. And maybe at a later point you'll discuss that, but I wanted to bring it up.
Doug Grout.
Just in response to Dr. Pierce's question, I'll support this motion to put this in the document for analysis, just like some of the other motions that are associated in this section. It'll depend on the analysis as to whether I vote for them and whether we agree to put them in state waters.
Anyone else? Matt.
I'm opposed to this for the reasons that Jim just laid out, that it doesn't make sense. And I think given the very finite staff time and staff resources we have and given how much more work they need to do, I'm going to oppose this because basically we're adding more work onto them, and I don't think this is the right way to go. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else? You waving at me, Tom, or did you have a comment? I didn't know if you were flipping me off. Or
So with request to workload, I just want to point out that the option already includes a no minimum size option, getting rid of it completely. And, the analysis would build off the analysis we've done for that.
Anyone else? Call the question. All those in favor? 13 in favor. Opposed? 3 opposed. Abstention? 1. 13-3-1. The motion carries.
Next issue is on page 61, section 4.2.4.3, gear requirements to reduce small mesh bottom trawl catches of Georges Bank Yellowtail.
So this relates back to the issue that we talked about a little while ago where we talked about a Georges Bank Yellowtail flounder sub-ACL for small mesh fisheries. Chris Brown and others talked about gear requirements. You're going to see a committee motion which suggests requiring a raised foot rope trawl. We took a little bit of liberty when we drafted the text, and while it doesn't specifically mention some of the gear, the drop chain gear, it's written to allow for not just the separator trawl, but other gear that may be identified, potentially including the drop chain gear. We have a provision in the regs which allow those gears to be approved by the regional administrator for use in other programs. We're basically expecting that we would extend that over.
Okay. There's a committee motion to add an option to require the raised foot rope trawl to be used in the Georges Bank broad stock area for small mesh fisheries, carried 801.
I'll go to the audience for comment. Chris Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not that I don't trust you guys, because I really do, but I would like to see it in parentheses or highlighted or mentioned somewhere other than the raised foot rope trawl is clearly not the other option, the only option. That is a net that is designed to catch exclusively whiting. It does not work on squid. It does not work on scup. It does not work on any number of other small mesh species that we target in southern New England. Or the squid fishery way down in Munson Canyon, Powell Canyon, up against the Hague Line. It doesn't work. So if we could possibly make it more of visually present or prevalent, I would appreciate it, because the industry is really starting to wrap its mind around these other gear types, and it is scared to death of the current existing raised foot rope trawl. That was the one that drove us to experiment and come up with other solutions. So if you could modify the language just a little bit, we would sleep tonight. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeff Kalin, I completely agree with the request that Chris just made. You know, that's why we got involved with the drop chain net at Cornell, to avoid this problem with the raised foot rope trawl not being able to be used in the squid fishery primarily. So this makes me nervous, too, that it's so narrow. So if some language could be developed to reflect what Tom said, that this could be broadened, that would be very helpful, because I don't think this works for us at the moment. Thank you.
Tom.
To read the language that I wrote in here to address some of this, and granted it's not in a motion, so it may need a change to the motion. What we wrote in here was that any vessel using a bottom trawl with a cod end mesh size of less than 5 inches in the stat areas would be required to use a trawl designed to minimize catches of flounders. Approved trawls include the raised foot rope trawl, separator trawl, rule trawl, rope trawl. Additional gear could be added to this list by the regional administrator using, and there's a process, I got to fill in the reg citation. I don't know that the drop chain net experiments have been reviewed by our research steering committee yet. I don't think they have, which is why I didn't put it specifically in this document yet. But once it had been reviewed by the research steering committee, then it would be eligible to go through this process and be approved if this language is acceptable to the council.
Dave Gatham.
Tom is correct. The other trawls haven't come before the research steering committee yet. On that point, on the other point, the other question I would raise is we don't regulate the squid fishery. This motion was specific to the whiting fishery on George's Bank. So do we have to request that the Mid-Atlantic, which regulates the squid fishery, adopt similar language? Or procedurally, that's one question I need answered. And the second is probably from Gene, does the language that Tom has added here satisfy the requirement for moving new approved gears into the fishery? Is that language sufficient?
Gene, I think he's referring to the language in 4243 on page 61 of the document.
That's correct. It's the first paragraph on that page, the bottom of that paragraph.
Yeah, I mean,
you like my reg citation, Gene?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't looked at this for a while to remember. I don't know if Tom, if you've
can help me out here. I mean, if it's, I would need some time to just study whether it meets those specific requirements, which I can do while I'm sitting here. But
the question was, if it gets approved by the Research Steering Committee and is an approved gear, is the language that's in this action, would that allow it to be included as an approved gear? It wasn't asking you to approve the gear today.
No. I just wanted to look at the regulatory text of this just to see. I'm presuming, I mean, I can get back to you on that.
All right, well, then I would make a motion to amend to add the language that Tom has here, at least for now, and then hopefully by the final meeting we'll have a ruling on whether this language is sufficient or we have to modify it some more.
Okay. Tom, does that need to be added in to this? I mean, wasn't the intent to use this language that's in there now?
Yeah, I think the intent is to use the language that's in the document, but the committee never saw this, and what Terry has put up is the actual language of the committee motion, which is very specific and just says the separator trawl. So to make things clear for the record, it would be helpful to have the council motion. The other thing while I've got the mic is that this is another question for Gene. Even though we don't manage the squid fishery, I think that we can impose this requirement in order to protect groundfish, but I'm leaving that up to Gene to address.
I'm getting confused by what's up there. That's not what you intended?
What I intended, I don't think Karen has the actual Framework 48 document. I don't know if Tom can. The language is, let me see if I can read it here. Approved trawls include the raised foot rope trawl, separator trawl, rule trawl, and rope trawl. Additional gear could be added to this list by the regional administrator using the process outlined in, and we have to get the correct citation. That's why it's 50 CFR something.
Seconded by Dave Preble.
So. Let me go over and I can give Karen.
Chairman Robin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was discussed that this was intended or developed for the whiting fishery, and I just wanted to ask if that was, in fact, the original intent, at least in the committee's work, or if it was their intent to expand this to include the squid fishery, and if so, if there's been any analysis of what the impacts of these gear modifications might be on the squid fishery.
Only if you're now allowing us to manage squid.
Negative.
Peter.
Well, yeah, that would kind of my question, too. Did you answer, Gene, what Tom had asked you, if we could do the squid?
Yes, I think you can, although we strongly encourage the council to request the council that primarily manages the fishery to do it, if possible, or at least to develop measures in coordination with the council that this council might adopt.
And that would be subsequent to the time that we actually pass this in the final motion, final action. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Jay. Yeah, just because of the follow-up, because at the committee meeting, I was just under the assumption it was whiting as well. So, I mean, I'll just have to think about it here including the squid with that.
Dave Gaethel.
I think we specifically said whiting and squid because they were the two fisheries that were designated that led to this yellowtail number. I think we were quite specific. And that's why I asked the question about whether or not we could regulate squid. The only net we listed at the time was the raised foot rope because we didn't, know what would be the appropriate nets for the squid fishery, recognizing that this would have to be fleshed out at this meeting.
Is that language?
That language is correct.
Okay. Further comments? I'll call the question on the motion to amend. All those in favor? Seventeen. Unanimous. Now we're on to the main motion as amended. Further discussion. Call the question. All those in favor? Seventeen. Unanimous. Terry.
Okay. We're on to the motion everyone's looking for the day. It's the last committee motion. With the exception of a motion on priorities, which I'll bring for tomorrow afternoon's discussion. And this motion is following up some advice from the groundfish advisors on mitigation measures for fishing year 2013. It's a committee motion to recommend the council request emergency action to eliminate the monkfish trip limit in the northern fishing area for limited access vessels fishing on a groundfish day at sea under sector management rules as one means of mitigating the reductions in groundfish annual catch limits pending for 2013. Pass the committee 5-2-3-1.
It's committee motion. I'm going to go to the audience for comments. Maggie Raymond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We support this motion. We're well under the ACT in our catch in this fishery. We have been well under it for the past 2 years. We have a history of having no trip limit in the northern fishery management area. It has not been harmful to the resource. In 1 year, I believe we did go over the TAC in that year, but in that particular year, there was a phenomenon. I think livers were like $20 a pound or something crazy like that, which we haven't seen since and are probably not likely to see again. So we really are looking for some kind of mitigation in the coming fishing year. And since we're well under this, under the ACT, which is a conservative number that is below the ACL as well, so there's a lot of buffers built into this plan, we should take every opportunity to, turn any kind of waste in this fishery into landings because it's a very, 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 very valuable resource. It's like $3.50 a pound pretty much every day of the week. So this would be this has the potential to, to provide some real mitigation for the cuts that we're taking in groundfish. So we would urge you to make this request to the agency, and we hope that the agency will support that. Thank you.
Jeff Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeff Kalin, Lunds Fisheries. You know, I know there's a joint Monkfish Committee and AP meeting on December 6th. Should this be something that's taken up then? This is news to me, not following groundfish as closely as some other people do. So it seems a little premature with that meeting coming up. I'd be interested to know what the monkfish advisors think about this, for example. We don't harvest monkfish. We process monkfish. But since that meeting's coming up, I wonder if this couldn't be considered on December 6th. Then it would give you a chance to take a look at it again on the 20th when you have your groundfish meeting. Thank you.
Anybody else in the audience? John Bullard.
As I understand it procedurally, if this comes, the council votes this as an emergency, I have to vote no to preserve the secretary's ability to vote on this. But I have a couple of questions. One, I guess, is similar to Jeff's. I don't understand why this is an emergency, number one. But number two, why this isn't something that the council takes up under the monkfish management plan. So perhaps that can be addressed in discussion.
Tom Dempsey.
Thanks, and I certainly recognize and appreciate John's position. I think the emergency that's driving this is the fact that there are, as I think Peter said at our last meeting, almost no healthy groundfish stocks in which to increase opportunities in 2013. We've declared this a disaster. There's almost nothing to put the groundfish fleet on that would allow them increased opportunities for profitable fishing trips in 2013. That's what's driving this. We have other fisheries. We have, as we've talked earlier, an integrated fleet. Groundfish, dogfish, monkfish, skates, and we have a fleet that traditionally has access to a number of fisheries. I think, and I support this motion, I think in the interest of getting us out of here on time and without burdening with additional motions, I'd actually move to amend this. While I support this motion, I think the council should also request NIMS take emergency action to allow the landing of barn door skates in the Northeast Skate Wing fishery. The intent of this motion is to treat catch and landings of barn door skate under the existing trip limits and management measures of the other stocks in the Northeast Skate complex. I think these both actually allow us to increase opportunities to turn wasteful discards into profits in 2013, and I'm happy to offer some more rationale if I get a second.
Is there a second? Laura Ramson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I won't belabor this. I've talked to a lot of folks about it. I've talked to the service. This came up under the Groundfish Committee discussion. Barn door skates is one of seven stocks in the skate complex. There's currently a landings prohibition on that. And while that stock hasn't been overfished and hasn't experienced overfishing in a decade, it's making progress to its rebuilding target. And actually, in the trawl survey, its index is higher than three of the other skates, which we currently are allowed to land and sell. We are still stuck with the landings prohibition. So all our scientific signals indicate that this stock is expanding, is increasingly robust, and fishermen on the water can't get away from them. We're literally throwing over millions of pounds of barn door skate every year. And in 2013, I just simply don't believe that we can afford to throw over things that we could alternately land and sell. So for all those reasons, I think we should treat barn door skate just like we treat everything else under a rebuilding program, allow landings, responsible harvest, and allow the fleet to make money on this resource as it rebuilds. Thank you.
Paul Howard.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just a process question. I don't know if the Groundfish Committee has discussed it, but is Tom going to do all this analysis, skate analysis, or is the skate committee and the skate PDT? And is the groundfish amendment going to become like an omnibus amendment and change the monkfish catch limit from the monkfish plan and the skate catch limit from zero as an omnibus amendment. I'm confused on how that'll be.
Tom, I had you next.
My understanding is this isn't for inclusion in the groundfish framework. These are council requests of NIMS for emergency action as a full council. The rationale is groundfish driven, but it's an emergency action.
George Sarson.
Oh, sorry, a couple things. One, to the barn door skate, it's my understanding this did go before the skate PDT for analysis and was not supported. And as a practical matter, a secretarial emergency can only be for up to 1 year. So then what? What would be the plan for either of these two actions to put them in place for a longer term?
Tom Dempsey.
That's a great question. We actually are working on specifications in both the monk and the skate plans this year. So specifications, new specifications packages will be on the water by 2014 in both of those FMPs. So the emergency action, as you said, would take 1 year. These would be in place or be in place for the 6 months and then continued. And then by 2014, we'd have new specifications that would allow us to make these changes on a permanent basis.
I have Tom Neese.
It's late, and I don't know how far you want to go. There is a document that Fiona prepared for the Groundfish Committee in your binder, document number 10, which briefly summarizes some of the skate information and also shows the skate survey indices on the second page, if anybody wants to refer to it. If you have any questions, Fiona would be glad to answer them.
Next, I have Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I think the full council should know that the Groundfish Committee debated this motion to amend for a substantial length of time and defeated it. The reason it was defeated is that the PDT didn't support it, that barn door skates are a long-lived, slow-growing species that doesn't spawn until it's about 17 years old, and that most of the increase in biomass of barn door skates, we don't know whether it's fish that are spawning or fish that haven't spawned yet. You really need a stock assessment, length frequencies, things of that nature, to be able to decide whether or not you should have a fishery for this. The other thing you need is whatever fishery you set for this is going to be extremely limited because of this unique life history aspect of this species, that it doesn't spawn until very late in its life. And I don't think this is something that should be in an emergency action. I think it's something that should come after we have updated the stock assessment, and it should go to the skate committee to determine what an appropriate trip limit for this species would be in recognition of its life history. So I will oppose the motion to amend.
Terry Stockwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Backing away from my chairmanship of the Groundfish Committee, my preference would have been to separate these two motions. To provide some context to the council and the audience, the Groundfish Advisors spent a significant amount of time working on looking at mitigation measures for emergency action on non-groundfish issues. They've been encouraged to think broadly and creatively. They came up with four issues, two of which the committee moved on, and then chose only to make a motion on the one on the monkfish. So, I would support the monkfish amendment, and I would like to separate the two, if that would be possible.
Tom Dempsey.
Well, I'm not clear if that was a motion to split. I don't think so. My sense is it's 10-6. We're going to vote on this motion to amend, which would create these two. If that fails, then we'd vote on the main motion, which is just the monkfish. So in terms of process, I don't think splitting it would actually increase the efficiency. To the point that Dave brought up first, the Groundfish Committee never voted on this. We discussed it. We heard the PDT's and the agency's concerns on it. The only people who did vote on this motion was the Groundfish AP, and they passed it unanimously. And we're bringing it here today because for the same rationale that the monkfish, the underlying monkfish motion, has been brought forward.
Further comment, Peter Kendall, then David Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom just spelled it out to me. That's exactly what I would think would happen on this, Terry, if you don't like the emergency action on the skates, then you can vote accordingly. But I agree with the amended motion. I think Maggie had said it at the last Groundfish Committee meeting, too. As far as the monkfish, there's nothing that we've done to help the industry in the near future to make any money for next year. And the monkfish will help, and this skate could possibly help, too. And I think, like Tom said, after this emergency action goes through, the skate committee can take up action. There'll be a stock assessment, and then we'll see where we're at with it. But I think for an emergency action, it's okay for 1 year. Thank you.
David Pierce.
At the Groundfish Committee meeting, I made a motion to move forward with monkfish as a mitigation measure. I thought it made a great deal of sense. I still do. The industry advisors made a very compelling and convincing case for moving it forward. With regard to barn door at the Groundfish Committee meeting, I was hesitant to support any motion that would include barn door skate. You know, I did note the similar to David Gethel, his recent reference that the life history of barn door skate, biological characteristics, the fact that not too many years ago barn door was actually NIMS was petitioned to list barn door as endangered. Well, that was years ago, over 10 years ago, I believe, and now looking at the assessment information provided to us by Fiona, I think it makes sense to include barn door in the mix and then, of course, to do the necessary analyses that will help us understand if indeed it warrants inclusion as emergency action. And I was convinced, well, since that Groundfish Committee meeting, I've been convinced that it should be included because of information Tom has provided and other fishermen have provided regarding the nature of their catch and their discard of barn door skate. If indeed they're catching millions of pounds of barn door skate, then that, to me, suggests that there's a need for us to seriously consider this, do the analyses, and then make the call, or NIMS can make the call as to whether or not it is warranted. NIMS has more at stake with barn door than we do, I think, because, once again, NIMS was petitioned for this endangered species years ago. So new status of the stock, desperate situation for the groundfish fishery, very few species or stocks to which the groundfish fishery can turn, monkfish, indeed, and barn door skate, possibly. So I will support this motion to amend.
Laura Ramson.
I don't want to belabor it. For all of the reasons that David said, I support it. And I don't think that the irony should be lost on the council that we have a listed species sturgeon that hasn't been looked at since 1998. So we don't have any problem shutting down fisheries from Maine to Florida and wreaking havoc on fisheries with zero data. If we know that the barn door are out there in plentiful numbers that are actually prohibiting the fishing for other species, perhaps we should let the fishermen target them. And again, just to reiterate what Dr. Pierce said, we are looking for mitigation measures in a really tough situation. So the fact that we're severely underfishing the monkfish and that there are the barn door in such plentiful quantities, and the fact that we don't seem to let the fact that we don't have up-to-date information harm us or slow us down when we're wreaking havoc on fisheries, I think we should move forward with this. Thank you.
Anyone else? Chairman Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the need for mitigation as it relates to the proposed monkfish action. I'll just share one concern that I've heard from some of our committee members in the Mid-Atlantic, and that is that they've expressed some question about the catching area relative to the management area. That is the fact that vessels are able to take trips in both the southern Manitoulin area and the northern Manitoulin area on the same trip. So there's been some question about being able to validate whether, in fact, catches are coming from one area versus the other. But I'll just look to them to carry that discussion through the committee process. That's probably the better forum for that. So I just want to note that for the record, but fully understand the need to try to achieve the mitigation that's been proposed.
Anyone else? Frank.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And seeing how Monkfish is jointly managed, would we be looking to ask the MID to support this before we ask the service, or are we going ahead without the MID?
I guess I'm struggling with, you know, with everything on the agency's plate, I'm not sure how quick an emergency can get done. Why is this being asked to be done through an emergency rather than through a Monkfish framework?
Tom Dempsey.
As I suggested, I think the rationale is groundfish driven and in recognition of the full integration and overlap between these fleets, that you can provide groundfish fishermen with additional opportunities in other fisheries that are underutilized that they have access to. In terms of not having time to do emergency actions, I remember it was maybe three groundfish committee meetings ago, we started with Sam Roush on the phone saying, we're looking at these ACL cuts, we have to do everything. We're going to work with you to do absolutely anything that we can figure out. We're going to spend the time. We're going to get innovative. I'm frankly pretty surprised that we wouldn't have time to consider two emergency actions that were effectively requested from the council.
Gene.
Yeah, I'm not saying not to do these things, and nobody made a promise that we would just do every emergency that was requested. I'm just saying the normal process, there is a process set up, a more full, transparent process that allows transparent analysis, and I'm just trying to get justification from the council why we should bypass that and bring this in-house to NIMS to do as an emergency.
Well, I believe that at least some of the discussion on all of this is focused on the fact that, you know, it is mitigation for the current, you know, groundfish disaster. So that's why I think it's being looked at on emergency. Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Fiona a question. Going through the information you provided at the last committee meeting, I don't see anything in there on the really the spawning stock status. Do we have any information to indicate, I don't think anybody disputes there's a lot of barn door skates out there, but are there spawning stock barn door skates out there, or are there just a lot of sub spawning stock barn door skates out there?
That I don't know off the top of my head. I'd have to go and look at the length frequencies from the trawl surveys and use that as a proxy, because I think we have some estimates of size at maturity that I could apply that to.
Okay. Well, I'll just remind everybody again, we're proceeding here basically blind. You're going to establish a fishery based on no biological information other than that the trawl surveys increase. And again, these aren't groundfish. They don't start spawning at age 2 or 3. And you know, I would urge extreme caution here. You're headed into waters. You don't, you know, they may be infested with sharks, and you're sticking your feet in there, and you don't know whether it's going to get bit off or not. So, vote for this if you want, but I hope the service will do a very, very careful analysis of whether or not we have established a sufficient spawning stock biomass for barn door skate to allow a fishery. Thank you.
Anyone else?
Just one last point on some of the life history. There was a study done at the Biodome in Montreal about the fecundity of barn door, and they found that one female laid 69 eggs in 1 year, and that increased over the years. But the egg incubation time ranged from 342 to 494 days. So it is, they don't produce as many eggs per year, and they're slow growing and maturing.
Anyone else in the council? Mark Gibson.
I oppose the amendment. I think the escaped inflation is an unnecessary complication to what was a clearer motion, so I'm going to oppose the amendment.
Anyone else? I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion to amend? Six in favor. Opposed? Ten opposed. Abstentions? One. The motion to amend fails. We're on the main motion. Further discussion? Dave Gaethel.
When we passed this motion, it was late and I was tired, and I've thought of something today that I need clarification on. Eliminate the monkfish trip limit in the northern fishery management area for limited access vessels fishing on a groundfish day at sea. Is that all monkfish vessels? In other words, right now we have categories of monkfish permits. And, you know, the incidental catch permits, the category E, is probably the largest number of permits in aggregate. And they have a trip limit and a percentage. In other words, it's tied to both. This just says trip limits. At the time, I assumed that the category E remained the same, but I'm not sure that's what this motion says.
Let me just see if somebody else can clarify. I would want to do it. Maggie.
Category E is an open access permit. This refers to limited access permits, so it would be C and D permits in the Northern Fishery Management Area.
Thank you for that. Anything further on the motion? All those in favor? Fifteen in favor. Opposed? One. Abstention? One. 15-1-1. The motion carries. Terry.
I have no further business, Mr. Chairman.
John Bullard.
I just have one question. I won't promise not to prolong this, but it was brought up a couple of hours ago, and I just have one question for Tom. Tom, the SSC, did they, in their report, give an overfishing limit for yellowtail flounder?
They did not give an overfishing limit for Georges Bank yellowtail.
Thank you.
Mary Beth.
So this had occurred to me because I think Jean had identified a couple of issues relative to our motion on yellowtail. And quite frankly, at this hour, I was going to bring it up tomorrow and not now. But Mr. Chairman, so whatever your wishes on that would be.
I don't know what your intention is.
Well, my intention is to ask the SSC to give us an OFL for Georges Bank yellowtail flounder because currently we don't have one, and that is problematic. I could make that motion now or I could make it tomorrow.
My suggestion would be to make it now so that if we know that if it either passes or fails, we may be able to begin to move that along to the SSC. I mean, they're meeting in essentially 3 days, so.
Okay. You know. Well, on that advice, I do make a motion that we request the SSC to provide an OFL for Georges Bank yellowtail flounder.
Seconded by Peter Kendall. I don't know if we need to specify the time. I mean, the way that says it could be next year, it could be a subsequent at the next meeting, maybe?
Well, I mean, that's a good point. Let's say at the earliest possible time in the motion, which ideally would be next Monday, but I hate to be so specific. I don't really know all of their schedule. But, I mean, the meeting on Monday, they could discuss it, I think. The agenda has been posted, but they're spending approximately 3 hours on herring, and the remainder of the time is for – actually, I have the agenda right here. The remainder of their time is a discussion about the risk policy workshop. So I think that, you know, they could have some kind of discussion about it on Monday. I'm not sure if they have enough information in which to do it on Monday. But so I'll leave the motion as it reads now.
Paul.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if they have the time or we can get them the data, but setting a reference point is usually not the job of the SSC. It's setting an ABC, which is like a snapshot for a catch limit. Setting reference points is something I think you have to look at an awful lot of data over an awful long period to determine BMSY and OFL and all that, or am I wrong?
Jim, can you bring us home?
Yeah, I think that the SSC could make that calculation. In an ideal world, it would not be a lot of work. But if there's a lot of question about what the current stock size is, then that would lead to a prolonged discussion about what the OFL is, because the calculation of OFL will be based on what the current stock size is. It could be a function of that as well as what the biomass target would be. And it's also related in some cases perhaps to whether the stock is in an overfished condition or not. So as I said, ideal world, a pretty quick calculation, but in this case I expect it, like a lot of yellowtail things, to get complicated.
Council. Chris.
I think you can make the request. It may be somewhat problematic because I think to determine an OFL, the SSC is going to have to choose a best model. And we have a model that resulted in a ABC recommendation of 200 tons, one that resulted in a recommendation of 500 tons, and then no model. Essentially, the implication was for the 1150 that models didn't work, so they used the previous year's ABC recommendation. So you can make the request. It may not be something that is going to be particularly easy for the SSC to reach agreement on.
David Pierce.
Yeah, I support the motion. It gets to the heart of the matter. We're all weary of this discussion about the SSC not giving us an OFL, so we'll ask them, and that will likely result in them giving us some further explanation as to why they didn't give us a specific one last time around. Maybe it'll result in them being extremely critical of the Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder Assessment and recommending that we not use it, and that it's not useful for management purposes. I'm open to anything they have to say about this issue. So let's deal with it, let's answer it, and that will assist John Bullard move this forward, because he needs to have this issue addressed. So we all do. So I will support the motion.
Frank Bond.
Yeah, thank you. If they don't have time to do this, can we at least ask them to give us a better definition of what a bycatch fishery is?
Tom Neese.
So I just want to make sure I understand the motion here. We're going to have to write terms of reference for the SSC to address this, and the terms of reference will be to ask them to specify an OFL, correct? Assuming this motion carries. We would not be asking them to review the assessments. We would be asking them to specify an OFL. And the next question is early as possible time. I don't know if there's any discussion at the council about what that means, right? I mean, quite honestly, we've asked some things of the SSC at the earliest possible time, and they've said, okay, we'll get to it 7 months from now because of their schedule. So, you know, I think it should be clear that if we mean earliest possible time, is there some deadline the council has in mind? And as you ponder that question, the issue is, what if they come back with an OFL that is lower than the ABC you approved today? Does that mean you're willing to revisit the ABC at this December council meeting? I think you might want to think through those as you answer the question of what you mean by earliest possible time.
Mary Beth.
I think that what we're looking for here is an overfishing limit for their ABC alternative of 1150. I think the other two alternatives that they provided us a range, which was a term of reference that we provided to them the last time around. They provided three options. Two of those options have an overfishing limit that's identified in the track. The third option does not. So I think that is what we're looking for. And as far as the earliest possible time, I mean, in an ideal world, they'd be able to do this on Monday. I don't know that that's real, and I don't know what the schedule is for the SSC or when they would meet next or what's on that agenda. So I guess I would ask Chris, do they have another meeting scheduled following the Monday meeting?
There's a meeting that will be scheduled in late January when they receive the COD assessment results. But it's possible to also initially begin the meeting or the discussion, and if they can't complete the setting of an OFL, that can be continued, another meeting scheduled, possibly done through a webinar. And while I have the mic, just to correct one impression, the reason they didn't set an OFL the last time was simply an oversight, because they got so involved in the discussion of setting an ABC, they forgot that the term of reference to look at the OFL the way that the terms of reference were laid out. So they didn't. It wasn't because they swept it under the rug intentionally.
So if we needed to insert in this motion a specific time limit, is our January council meeting a doable time frame for this?
Tom?
Quite honestly, that in my mind, that is kind of late, right? Because I've got to write a document, ideally, and submit it before the January council meeting. And in that document with the 1,150 metric ton ABC, I've got to craft an argument why that does not exceed the OFL. And right now, I don't have an argument that does that. It's really, to have them report to us at the January council meeting what the OFL is kind of late, because ideally, if we want these quotas to go in place by May 1st, we need to get the document over to NIMS before the January council meeting. I'd also point out that you made some suggestions, Mary Beth, on exactly what you want them to do that really aren't incorporated in the motion. You said you want an OFL specifically for their 1,150 metric ton ABC. I don't know if that's what other council members want, because they didn't specify an OFL for the other amounts either. So I don't know if you want to try and incorporate that language in your motion.
Thanks, Tom, for that, because I did. I was specific to, I don't think it's called Alternative 3 in their report, but it is item number 3, the three different ABC options that they provided to us. And my understanding was, and I could be wrong, that the first two flowed from the assessment, and the assessment would have set an overfishing limit. I could be wrong about that. Do you know if that's correct, Tom, or not?
No, because that is incorrect, because the track does not really deal in the OFL world. I mean, there's a number that is equivalent, but it's not like the assessment comes out and says this is the OFL.
So in light of that, I'm not sure if we were asking him for, I mean, I hate to ask him for an OFL for the other two, in which you know, spinning their wheels. We want them to respond to us quite quickly when that's not really the issue we're trying to get at. So I think I'll leave that at you know, at their ABC recommendation number three. And given Tom's advice on the time limit, I guess we should ask them if they can have it back to us by December 20th.
I think it needs to read up there in that second line. It says at, yeah, right where your cursor is at there. It should be four. Is that okay with the seconder? Is that okay with the seconder?
I'll possibly put 1150 in parentheses after number three. 1150 metric ton.
Further discussion.
Maybe it could be a backstop. Oh,
I know it's getting late, John. I know it's getting late. Call the question. All those in favor of the motion? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. 14 in favor. Opposed? 1, 2, 3. 3 opposed. Abstention? None. Okay. 14-3. The motion carries. Is there anything else to come before us with groundfish this evening? Seeing none, I was asked yesterday, I had to haul the water for the Fishery Survival Fund. The Pew Environment Group asked me to let everybody know that they are having a reception across at the Barking Crab, which started, 17 minutes ago. And anyway, so they're doing a presentation on forage fish. And we will start tomorrow at 8:30. Thank you all for your work today.